Good afternoon. So last time we kind of finished up our discussion of memory caches. We talked about how kind of our idea of index and tag and offset bits map to kind of actual code, thinking especially about arrays, which is usually where we're most concerned about cache performance, because if we're dealing with a lot of data, usually there's some sort of array involved. Kind of thinking about how arrays map to caches and so on. And question? Yes.
I'm sorry, I think
my mic is on. That is indeed correct. Okay. This better? Yeah, okay. This turning the mic on, the switch on helps turn the mic on. Okay. So last time we talked about C code and cache misses, particularly about how arrays map to our cache tag index and offset bits. In particular, like looking at, you know, cases where we could have there be lots of misses, typically from like not kind of, you know, having good spatial locality in our accesses and therefore spreading them out in convenient ways among sets, where we have fewer misses. And then we looked at some missing pieces, and the big one was handling writes. That we talked about caches for reads, which is most of what our program does, but, you know, reading memory is not very useful if we can't write it in the first place. And we had these two big decisions we needed to make when handling writes. So one was, what do we do when you have a cache access and the value is not in the cache and it's a write? And we have a choice to, we can do write allocate, meaning we add it to the cache like we did for reads, or we can do write no allocate where we don't. And then we have a question of, well, if we modify a value in the cache, when do we update the next levels? We want to update them eventually, but we can defer that update. And we prefer to defer that update from a sort of pure performance point of view, because, you know, maybe it's the case that we'll be able to avoid sending that update in right away, and therefore there'll be some other updates to the value or the cache block, and we can kind of consolidate them into one update later. And the idea of not updating immediately was called write back. And write allocate plus write back was the kind of our majority policy. So this was write through is the opposite policy. There. And we mentioned that when we're doing write back, you know, our write through equals immediate, write back equals delayed. I put the wrong one on the slide. When we're doing write back, the reason why that wasn't just a thing we always do is, well, there's extra bookkeeping there. We need to keep track for each block if it's modified, which we call being dirty, and when we have to evict that, when something else is read into the cache to replace that block, we need to look at that and possibly initiate a write, which means that a normal read to the cache can involve a whole bunch of extra steps to handle this write-back process. It turns out that sort of most modern processors end up using write-back, write-allocate caches these days, but that not the case for some more embedded cases, and hasn't been always been the case historically. So questions about things we covered last time? Yes?
Sorry, this is completely off topic. Are we going to talk about the quiz?
Are we going to talk about the quiz? I was not planning on it.
I think it might be a mistake.
You might be mistaken with other questions? Okay, so it's possible that we made a mistake in the key somewhere, and we'll get to that. Which question?
Question three.
I think the array access at 54 is missed on the first. That should also be because it's a cat. Oh, and I just did not include 54 in my list in my work. So yes, that is wrong. Because yes, I had my work and I just didn't include 54 in that whole thing. So yeah, I will go back and adjust the key for that. Yeah.
Also question five.
Question five. I need to look at that in, I will look at that if, so question five, what should happen here? So we have how many bytes are written, we have a write, no allocate write back cache. So we read and we write, so now the block with tag 40 is dirty, then we read from tag 41, we read from tag 42, and we have a two-way LRU cache. So this is going to evict 40, which is going to write back the whole block, which is 16 bytes. Then we read from 43, which is going to evict 41. And then we write to 30, which is not going to evict anything. So I get 18, which maybe I forgot to put in the actual key, but.
So I interpreted it as, well, it specifies bytes for memory problem to cache, so I didn't count the 2 bytes.
Okay, so the question is, you didn't count the 2 bytes. So if you remember, I guess, yes, I probably should have been more explicit, but if you remember, we said that the kind of way things worked is that the CPU went to the cache, represent with our dollar sign, went to memory, right? All our memory accesses go through the cache. We don't like ask the cache, and if it says no, go to memory. So that's why that interpretation was intended. I agree, I could have been clearer, but I think, you know, that matches what, how we explain how the cache works with the processor. Yes? And so it, conceptually, it bypasses being stored in the cache. Is what we meant by that. It's commonly referred to as bypassing the cache, but it's like going, you know, it goes to the cache and gets forwarded from the cache without being processed, is what we mean by that. Does that answer your question? Yeah, but I agree we could have been, I should try to think in the future of how to phrase those things that clearer, more clearly, but we're going with the model that the way our processor accesses memory is we always go through the cache. We never talk to memory directly. Yes?
I'm sorry, I read it as like being written, like data being written from the cache, like as it's stored in the cache.
Yes, so maybe we'll add some things to the key. I'll talk to my TAs who are grading it, because they'll also be looking at the comments and may have opinion, and I want to be consistent, make sure that's all consistent. Okay. Other things on the quiz? And yeah, so I need to look at quiz Q, which is the one. Oh, did I? Nope. Where did I put that one? I need to look at quiz question 3, missing 54. Okay. 3. So that's just, I need to update the key and then fix that. Yeah, and you can see in my work what I was missing. Okay. So some last things before we finish talking about caches, just to mention briefly. So we've seen kind of the typical multi-level hierarchy we have for caches. So typically we have, on each core, we have an L1 and then an L2 and then an L3 cache. Shared. And kind of the reason we have this hierarchy is that if you look at sort of what gets us our best performance, you know, the first level cache needs to be really fast. And we can only make it so big and achieve that. So that kind of determines the size of our L1 cache. And we can think of the higher level caches as kind of lowering our miss rate, our effective miss rate. And we can afford to have them be much bigger because, you know, we can pay more time to make the sort of actual, like, big miss rate lower. But we need to have that kind of minimum time be, like, in the 1 to 2 cycle range, and you just can't make your cache that big and achieve that. The other thing is we kind of skipped over, and we're deliberately kind of missing the topic of whether caches deal with virtual or physical addresses, with our summary being that caches have physical addresses. And this may strike you as, you know, maybe not the best strategy, right? Because this means that before we even access the cache, we're going to have to do this extra step. And we're going to talk about TLBs, which are going to be an extra piece of hardware we're going to add just to make our page table lookups fast. And we need to be super fast, because otherwise we can't even look up values in the cache quickly. And another strategy you could imagine that some real processors have done is we could use virtual addresses to access the cache, meaning we could have the cache have tags and indices that are based on our virtual addresses. The big reason why most processors haven't done this is that this means that you have to deal with what happens when two different processes use the same cache in close proximity to each other. So you need to like add extra stuff to the tag or clear the cache when we context switch from one process to another. And what happens if we have two different processes that share memory? If they have different addresses and we're using the virtual addresses, then the cache doesn't really know about that unless we do some extra work. You can solve these problems, because there have been systems which do, but kind of the modern consensus is that people build processors where the caches only deal with physical addresses. But we do take this little shortcut, which is that often we'll arrange for our virtual address to physical address translation. But remember, we take our offset and copy it, and we do a page table lookup to get our page number. We'll arrange for this to be laid out such that our, that's not what I want, this, that our cache index bits and our physical address are part of just the page offset. And if we do that, we have the value for the cache index bits in the virtual address. We don't need to go through the page table lookup to get those. So we'll do the cache index lookup without doing the translation, because we know the cache index doesn't change if we lay out our cache correctly. And then we'll do the tag check with the physical address after the translation. And that's what kind of most modern processors have settled on, as kind of a compromise between all the complexity of dealing with what if two processes are using the same memory, with if we try to use virtual addresses, versus like the full slowdown of I have to do the whole translation before I can access the cache with just physical addresses. So questions on our virtual addresses and caches? Okay, so I mentioned that, so our modern solution is we're gonna do this page table lookup, and we're gonna have some special hardware to make it fast. And that hardware is gonna be the TLB. So let's remind ourselves what the page table lookup looks like, right? We're doing this multi-level process on a typical current processor, where we have our first level page table, we take part of the virtual address, look up in there, then a second level, and then we actually get to the actual level. And this means that we're typically doing multiple memory accesses. So in this case, I have a two-level page table, and I'm accessing memory, or my cache, one time to retrieve the first level page table entry, another time to retrieve the second level page table entry, and a third time for the actual data. And even if these are all cache hits, this means we're doing three cache accesses for every memory access. And by memory access, I mean machine code and data. And two levels is actually not very realistic today. If we think of my laptop, for example, it has four-level page tables. So we'd be doing five cache accesses per memory access. And the typical latency of a level one cache access is something like 2 cycles. So we'd be saying that we're adding 8 cycles just for the page table lookups to every memory access. And this means that, and this includes instruction fetching, so this is 8 cycles on every instruction, and an additional 8 cycles if the instruction is a move to or from memory. And that's just not acceptable. That's not a thing we can tolerate, so no processor works this way. You know, so even if these were all cache hits, it's still way too slow. And our solution is we're going to add a new special cache that is way faster, but only works for these page table lookups. And the reason we can get away with this is going to be because of how page table lookups work. That, you know, just like with normal caches, we said, the reason our caches worked is we had locality. Page table lookups have locality, and they have really, really good temporal locality. And to think of why that's the case, let's say I'm running a program here, and we're going to run some code and some function. And that function is like down here. And, you know, let's say that function's working on an array we allocated on the heap, so that array might be over here. And it's going to be using some local variables on the stack. Well, let's think of how many pages each of those take up. You know, a page on, say, my laptop is 4 kilobytes. 4 kilobytes of machine code is a huge function. A function maybe like kind of near the end of one page and beginning of other, but typically it's not going to be spanning more than 2 pages for the code. So that's 2 page table entries we actually care about for the function's code. If I have an array, you know, if my array on my heap is, you know, less than a couple kilobytes, that's 1 page. Even if it's like 10 kilobytes, that's 3. We're dealing with very small numbers of pages. And on the stack, you know, unless I'm storing many kilobytes of stuff on the stack, that's going to just be 1 or 2 pages again. So in total, my function probably is only accessing, you know, like 8-ish pages, you know, at any given time. Like that's all that active. And we're accessing each of those repeatedly. We have super great temporal locality for those page table entries. And the page table entries that we're accessing are very small. The pages aren't. The pages are huge. But the page table entries, just the sort of virtual, the physical mapping, just that table, that's the part we care about of the page table is very small. Remember, each page we just represent with the physical page number. That's one number. So basically, we're storing, you know, like 8-ish numbers plus valid bits and writable bits at a time. We can make that really fast. So we're going to have a special cache for these page table entries. And because IBM made some poor decisions in the 70s, it's called a TLB, or translation look-aside buffer. And this is going to be organized like our memory caches we've seen, but we're going to store a different thing and look up with a different thing. So with our memory cache, we looked up with the physical addresses. With our TLBs, we're going to look up virtual page numbers. We're just going to look up the virtual page number in the TLB. That's all it cares about. It's just virtual page number to page table entry. Our TLB is not going to store any actual data. It's just going to store the page table entry. To actually get the data from that page, we need to take the page table entry, take the physical page number from it, concatenate with our page offset, and access the normal cache. So this is a step we're taking, you know, our kind of conceptual diagram. So we take the virtual address, we split off the VPN, we send that through the TLB, we get a valid bit and other permission bits, and the physical page number, and we combine that with our page offset. And this goes and accesses our actual cache. So this is a cache before the memory cache. We're just getting that physical page number and a bit of metadata. So we're only caching the page table lookup, and we're not, for a multi-level page table lookup, we're just caching the final result. So we take the virtual page number and get the last level page table entry. We don't care about any of the ones in the middle. We just want the actual last physical page number. And when we do a lookup, we're getting a virtual page number, which means that we're going to divide up our virtual page number into an index and a tab. Just like we had a physical address that we got into our memory caches, we divide up into index and tag. Same thing with our virtual page number. So in our L1 cache, we stored a whole bunch of bytes of memory together. In the TLBs, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do the equivalent of that. So we could store multiple page table entries together. We're not going to do that. Each block in our TLB is going to be one page table entry. And this is because there's not much spatial locality between page table entries. Yes, there's not none, but there's not much, so it's not really worth storing multiple page table entries and fetching multiple page table entries together. So we'll have one page table entry for a block, so each entry is sort of kind of like one cache block. This also means we're going to have no block offset bits. We had offset bits in our memory caches because once we got the thing from the cache, we need to decide what part of the block is it. In our TLB, the block is the whole entry. There's no offset bits to worry about, which is why we're just going to divide our virtual page number into tag and index. There's no offset. And because our set of active page table entries is pretty small, we're going to be able to make our TLBs pretty small. So typical TLBs will be tens of entries, not, you know, like L1 caches typically are hundreds or thousands of entries. And because they're so small, this will mean that if you look at the specs for a typical TLB, it will often be much higher associativity than an L1 cache might be, because we can make fast, highly associative caches for small things. It's hard to do that for big memories. Some questions about kind of generally the sort of TLBs as kind of an extension of like our memory caches. Okay. And just reminding what I said on the last page, since this is a point of confusion, the TLBs cache the valid last level page table entries. If it's invalid, we're not going to bother because a program is not going to repeatedly access an invalid page table entry. There's no need to cache it. And if it's not the last level, we're not going to bother because that's not something we can use directly to actually access the normal cache. So we're only going to store the last level entries. So this means if we think of our lookup, you know, the good case, the TLB hit case, is we're going to take our virtual address, we're going to take the virtual page number and the page offset, we're going to split that up, we're going to take the whole virtual page number, the whole thing, the parts for all the levels together, and send that to the TLB. And when there's a TLB hit, the TLB will just give us the page table entry, and we've skipped all the steps of the page table lookup. Now, obviously, we're not always going to have a TLB hit. So sometimes we'll go through all the steps of the page table lookup, and at the end, in addition to forming our address the normal way, we're going to send the page table entry we found to the TLB with the virtual page number that we looked up, you know, the whole thing, not just the like last part. And the TLB will store that, so hopefully next time we have a TLB hit, we don't do the lookup again. Okay, so questions? And this placement on our TLB lookup. Okay, so we know kind of how the TLB fits in conceptually, and I mentioned that it's going to be very much like our serve memory caches, and we're going to use the same organization. So we're going to take our address from the processor, and the VPN is the part of the address that goes to the TLB. B, and the address also has a page offset, and the TLB never sees the page offset. There's no point where it sees it. We just remove that from the address before consulting the TLB, and we put it back on after we get the result from the TLB. And we're going to divide our virtual page number into an index and a tag. And in this example here, well, we have three index bits. And that means we must have 2^3 or 8 sets. So we have 8 sets. And each set contains 2 entries, 2 ways, equals 16 entries total. So this TLB can store 16 page table entries. And each page table entry, each thing we're storing here is a, here we are, is a page table entry. So this is a page table entry, this is another page table entry. Each thing we store in the TLB is a page table entry. Now, when we look up a page table entry, we still need to do the same things we did with our normal caches and figure out, did this come from the right page table entry? And, you know, is it valid? So we have our valid bit and our tag. So, for example, in this case, if we look up this row here, we're going to say we have these two candidate entries, and we're going to compare our tag, that's the part of our virtual page number we didn't use yet, the part that's not, didn't tell us which row to go to, and we're going to use that and compare it to, in this case, our two entries tags and see which if any matches. Probably in a more realistic TLB, we might have like 8 ways or something like that. And then we'll get our page table entry, and what we'll ultimately be doing is we'll take this physical page number and we're going to concatenate it with this page offset. And that's going to be our physical address. Or alternately, we can think of this as our physical address. We could compute it arithmetically by saying it's going to be the physical page number times the page size plus the page offset. So plus 010110 in base 2. That's not something the TLB is going to do. That's whoever uses the TLB's result is going to handle that process. So questions about the mechanics of our TLB lookup? All seem comfortable or bored? Okay. So given that, we can go through an example. So let's say I have a 4 entry, so it stores 4 page table entries, 2-way TLB with an LRU replacement policy, and it's initially empty. So first question here is how many index bits do we have? I'll give you a minute, you can check with your neighbors. How many index bits does this TLB have? Yes, question? When I say four entries, I mean it stores four page table entries, yes, in total. Four page table entries stored in total. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we have exactly zero index bits, exactly one index bit, exactly two index bits, exactly three index bits, four or more index bits? Okay, so we have a split between one and two, so we definitely need to talk about this. So we have four entries, so that we store four page table entries, and we have two ways. So two ways means that we store two blocks, and blocks in this cache are page table entries, equals entries per set. So if we have two entries per set, so four entries, and we have one set for two entries, this gives us two sets. And remember, sets is kind of our row, so what that means is that our TLB looks like kind of like this, where this is entry, entry, and we also have a valid bit and a tag. And we have, you know, way zero and way one. We have two ways, and each of the ways has, you know, we have two sets, so two rows. So we have set zero and set one. And our index bits tell us which of the two sets to go to. So we need one index bit. There are two sets, we need one index bit. So I get one, you know, which is, you know, from log base 2 of two sets. Questions on how I got that answer? Okay, so we have one index bit. And the next question is, if our program is accessing virtual address hex 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, what is the index bit? So I'll give you a little time to figure it out, discuss with your neighbors. Thank you. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks it's gonna be zero? Who thinks it's gonna be one? No clue? Okay, we have a remarkable split for that. So the answer I get is that it's gonna be zero. So what are my steps here? So we know that the way the TLB is gonna work is that we're gonna take this virtual address and we're gonna split it up into our virtual page number and our page offset, and the TLB never sees the page offset. That's just gonna go around it. We're gonna take this virtual page number and that's what goes into the TLB. Because each of our TLB entries is for the whole virtual page, you know, just uses the virtual page number. And our virtual page number in this case, with 4,096 byte pages, that's 2 to the 12 bytes, which means our page offset is 12 bits. So this part of the address is the page offset, so our virtual page number is 0x12. And like with our memory caches, the index is the least significant bits that are left after we deal with all the offset stuff. And so we convert this into binary. We end up with a bunch of zeros, then 10010. And this bit here, this is our index bit. And all this stuff up here, this is our TLB tag. So I got an index bit of 0 from that. And I assume the thing that most people were missing is that, you know, when we do the TLB lookup, the TLB never sees page offsets. Questions on how I got that answer? Okay, so now that we know how to do that, let's say I have a program doing some memory accesses, and we have a TLB, same layout as before, so same way of getting the index bits. And it starts initially empty. We do these accesses. How many TLB hits and misses do we have? Like, where are they? And what's in the TLB when we're all done? So I'll give you a little time to work through this. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we have two or fewer hits? Okay, how about exactly three hits? Exactly four hits? Five or more hits? Okay, so we have pretty good agreement that they're exactly three hits. That's what I get. And as far as solving this, first thing I do is I say, well, TLB doesn't see the page offset. That's just, you know, done outside. So I can strip off the page offset, which we know is 12 bits with 4,096 byte pages. So that's the last three hex digits. And I can figure out what TLB index do each of these use. And it's going to be based on the virtual address, the physical address. That's what comes out of the TLB in the page table entry, but it's not how the TLB looks anything up. And so I just look at the least significant bit of my virtual page numbers, which is 0, 0, 0, 0, 1 for D, 0, 0, 0. So all but one of these axes accesses TLB index 0. And the other accesses TLB index 1. Yes? Wouldn't the what? Oh, wouldn't the last access also be 1? Yes, sorry. So D is, yeah, sorry, index 1, because it's D is odd. Everything else is even. So you can kind of work out what happens, just kind of simulate it. And in this case, I'm keeping a list of what sets are in the TLB. And because we have an LRU replacement policy here, when I access virtual page number 440, I need to take the page table entry, I need to put the page table entry for virtual page number 440 in the TLB, and it's not, and I have to choose the least access thing, which is going to be the 7FFE one. And similarly, when I put in 7FFE, I need to, sorry, when I put in 664, I need to remove the least recently used thing before, which was 440. I was applying my replacement policy, similar to what you did in the locker. And if we think of what's the final contents of the TLB, so I have kind of one representation of it, but I'm missing a bunch of details. So if we think of what's really going on there, you know, we're going to store our, we have four entries. Each of them has a valid bit and a tag. And our tag is constructed by taking our virtual page number and stripping out the index bit. So since there's only one index bit, that's shifting by one. We have our page table entry, which has our physical page numbers, our permission bits, and whatever else is in a page table entry. We also have to track the LRU information, so that's tracks, you know, some other bits. Questions? This exercise. Okay, so that's where I'm going to finish up talking about TLB. So any questions about TLBs before we move on to talking about threads? TLBs are caches. Okay, so our next big topic is going to be threads. And threads, we mentioned earlier when we talked about processes, we said a process is one or more threads, which we said represented kind of virtual processors, and an address space, which kind of represented a virtual memory. We've talked about how the virtual memory part worked, and we said the kind of virtual process part worked because we would context switch, we would save the registers and so on somewhere and load some different ones to switch from one thread to another. We're going to talk about threads in the context of writing code that intentionally uses multiple threads, often in the same process. And there's kind of two motivations for doing this. Why would I have one process that has multiple threads? One is what we can call concurrency, is that I want to do different things at the same time. So like if I'm running a web server, I might, you know, find it easier to write the code to handle one user accessing my web server and run multiple copies of that and have the OS handle making them appear to run at the same time. Same thing for a web browser. I might find it easier to write code to handle one web page at a time and have my OS handle making multiple of those happen at the same time. or other ways of dividing up tasks within an application. And this kind of threading is useful even if I only have one real processor. Because even if there's only one real processor, I'm still getting the benefit of being able to write my programs in maybe a more natural way and having the OS worry about making this appear to happen at the same time on my single processor. If I have multiple processors, or multiple cores, I have the advantage that maybe I can get more work done in total because I can use more than one core at a time if the OS decides to take my two threads for different web pages and run them at the actual same time on different cores. But this concurrency idea is useful even if we only actually can run one thread at a time physically. Another reason, and a reason we'll explore in an upcoming assignment, is parallelism, that we have one thing to do, and indeed, the most straightforward way to do that might be with a single-threaded piece of code, but we really want to take advantage of the hardware having additional processors or cores we can use. So we'll deliberately split up a task between multiple threads in order for us to be able to take advantage of that additional hardware resource. And that's commonly known as parallelism. So for either of these sort of use cases, we'll end up commonly using what's called a multi-threaded process. That previously we've had this idea that our process has a single thread, it's running some function, and that thread has a stack and some registers and a program counter. In our multi-threaded process, we'll have our process, which will still have a single set of open files, a single process ID, a single set of code that was loaded from its executable, a single set of global variables, and a bunch of stuff that's shared for the whole process, but we'll have multiple threads, and each of those threads are going to have per thread state. So they're going to have their own stacks. They're going to have their own values for all their registers. So each thread will have a current value for RAX. That might be different than all the other threads. They'll have their own program counter because they're executing independently, just like we saw different processes executing independently, and so on. But they'll all share these per process things, like what files are open and what process ID it has and what signal handlers are set up and so on. So questions about this multi-threaded process? So this is kind of the model we want, and we're going to show you the Unix API for actually using multi-threaded processes. And this is through what's called pthreads from POSIX threads, POSIX being the standard for these threads. And kind of our basic thing we want to do is we want to create threads. So this is going to be kind of similar to fork, except we're not going to make a new process. We're going to make a new thread in the current process. And this function is going to work a little differently than fork. We're not going to do the rather confusing, the function returning twice thing. Instead, we're going to do the probably more sensible idea that we're going to tell pthread create, this library function, here's where I'd like this thread to start. In this case, I'd like it to start in the compute pi function. And it will start there. In this thread, I want to start in the print classes function, and it will start there. So when we run this, we'll have our main running. It will start a new thread called that runs compute pi and a new thread that runs print classless. And these threads will run potentially starting immediately after the pthread create. As for when exactly they'll run, just like when we forked, it was kind of variable when the child process would run versus the parent. Same thing's true here. We don't know exactly when the OS will get a chance to actually run each of these three threads. We just know that they're all eligible to run, and probably the exact timing is going to depend on everything else going on in the system. So we have this pthread create function, and we have some arguments here. So one thing we see is being done is we have our first argument is a place to put the thread identifier. So a pthread T is kind of like the equivalent of a process ID, but for a thread in our process. And pthread create, like some other functions we've seen, doesn't actually return the thread ID, return the value, you know, as its return value. Instead, it fills in a value you give it, gave it a pointer to. It does have a return value. That return value is either zero, indicating it worked, or some error code. We also are passing in a function to run. This is a function pointer, and it's a pointer to a function that takes a void star argument and returns a void star. If you don't want to do that, well, too bad. You can't use pthread create. Most likely what you'll do is you'll create a function which has that prototype and have it call some other function. And this function is where the thread's going to start, and when this function returns, the thread terminates. We also have these two arguments I leave as null. The first one is for thread attributes. So here we can specify some extra settings for the threads. We'll have some examples of that next time, of what those extra settings might be. And we can specify what the argument to the function is. So this void star argument here, we can fill that in with a value. In this case, I've just passed null both times, but I could have passed some other value that's a void star to those functions. So questions on pthread create? So we see how pthread create works. And let's look at kind of one interesting case of using it. So here I have a function, I print a program, I print out a back to start thread, I have a place to put my thread ID for this thread I'm creating, and I call pthread create to create the thread, store the ID and the thread, and call print message, you know, and pass null to the ignored argument value, and then I print done starting thread and return. And when I run this, about 4% of the time, this prints in the thread. 96% of the time, it just prints done starting thread and terminates. So what's going on? So this is a preview of something we'll be taming a bunch over next several lectures, which is that we can often have kind of non-deterministic behavior when we write code with threads. And we'll generally call these race conditions. And what's going on here is that when we return from main, the way main works is returning from it is like, this return zero is like doing an X set zero. That's how main works. And the xset function xsets the entire process. Xsetting the entire process means all the threads. So in the times when things aren't getting printed out, what's happening is we're running our main thread that runs main. It, you know, creates the thread, prints f and returns, and my print message thread, maybe it gets started, but it doesn't get far enough to actually print anything before I call xset, and the OS cleans up all the threads of the process. Some questions on how this situation occurred. So we have this kind of non-deterministic behavior because it depends, like, exactly how fast does the OS schedule printf message thread, you know, the printf message, print message call. You know, it could happen, you know, right when printf call, pthread create is called, like it could just run really fast. Maybe we only have one core and the OS decides to switch right away, or maybe it waits a while and it never gets a chance to even start. So this is non-deterministic. And if we're writing threaded code, we don't really want our code to behave very differently depending on exactly the timing of the system. So we're going to want some solution. And our first solution here is that we can use this function called pthreadJoin. And pthreadJoin is kind of like, you know, wait PID, but for threads. For threads. So wait PID would wait for a process to finish or just return right away if it already finished. PthreadJoin, same thing. It waits for a thread to finish, or if the thread is already finished, it just returns. And waitPID collects the exit status of the thread. Sorry, waitPID collects the exit status of the process. PthreadJoin collects the return value of the thread, which is what this null argument is for. Where I'm just not caring what it is, that's why I'm passing a null, but we could pass in a place to store the return value. So if I call pthreadJoin here, I will always see in the thread printed out because we're waiting for the thread to finish before we allow main to return. Now, potentially, in the thread could be printed out, you know, up here. That's fine. You know, or it could be printed out before we print done starting thread, or it could be printed out later. That's still non-deterministic, but we know that we're not going to return from main and terminate the program until after print message has finished. So this is mentioned, this is probably the most straightforward way to fix it, and pthreadJoin is probably the most straightforward way of making sure threads kind of coordinate. This joining operation, you know, is equivalent to our waiting operation with processes. Another thing we can do is that we can have main not call exit. So I mentioned our problem was that main was calling exit, and that exits the whole process. So we can have main instead call this function to just exit the current thread. And there's a way of doing that. It's the pthreadExit function. And like with here, when we return null, this is kind of equivalent to doing pthread exit of null. Just like returning zero for main was equivalent of doing exit of zero, kind of like the equivalent of exit, but only for a thread, is pthread exit. And if we do this, well, what can happen is that, well, the thread that's running main can terminate before the print message thread terminates, but the process is still around because as long as the process has at least one thread, the OS can continue running it. When the process, all the threads of the process exits, then the process actually goes away. So I don't recommend this, as it says on the slide, because I think you probably should know which threads are active in your program. And not kind of rely on happenstance to make that work out. And, you know, I feel like you can make this work, but I feel like in sort of more typical programs, this is a way to have your user try to exit your program and it not exiting. You know, kind of undesirable behavior. Okay, so we saw pthreadExit and pthreadJoin. So pthreadJoin, you know, we give it a thread ID, a pthreadT, and a pointer to a place to put the return value, or null if we don't care. And it waits for the thread to exit, or just returns immediately if the thread's already exited, and collects its return value into that thing we're pointing to. And it returns an integer indicating whether it was successful or not. So typically it returns zero, meaning it's successful, but like if you called it with an invalid thread ID or something like that, it will return something else. And we have pthreadExit, which exits the current thread and sets the return value for the thread. And is also what happens when we return from a function pthreadCreate calls. It implicitly calls pthreadExit for us just like returning for main implicitly calls accept. Okay, so questions on pthread join and pthread accept? Yeah. Okay.
When we're creating a thread, is it just essentially allocating new space for the stack?
So the question is, where is the space for the thread allocated? So we're going to learn that the stack is going to be allocated in the virtual address space of the process. Typically, somewhere above the heap and below the main thread stack, but not necessarily. And so that's the stack. And the other things, where they're stored is going to vary, but most commonly, we're going to store the thread's registers and so on, the same place we stored the main thread's registers, but the OS is going to manage that. Does that answer your question? Yeah, so the thread we're creating, we have this variable, but this stuff here is usually in OS memory or on core, on processor, depending whether the thread is running or not. And this stuff here, this is, part of, the address space of the process. So pointed to by our page table somewhere. So we're looking at our pthread API, and something I want to mention explicitly, because I'm going to be sloppy about it on a lot of the slides, is that pretty much all the pthread functions return a value representing whether there's an error or not. And if you're running pthread code, you really should check these return values. So for example, pthread create can fail because there were insufficient resources to create another thread. And it sure would be nice to know that that happened rather than have your program hang because you thought a thread was created and in fact pthread create did nothing. And this is the same is true for a bunch of other functions. On the slides, I'm often going to omit error checking, but obviously, it's a good idea in practice. It just takes up space on the slides. That's not usually what I'm trying to explain. But really, you should be error checking. So let's, now that we know the API, let's start looking at some maybe more practical examples of using commits. So I'm going to have this running example. We'll probably continue doing beginning of next time. We're going to have an array, and we're going to sum up the array across multiple threads. So this is an example of the parallelism idea. The most straightforward way of writing this code would use a single thread, but we're going to sort of figure out how we can write it so that potentially you could take advantage of multiple processors to do this sum operation. And to make this actually useful, probably the array should be bigger than it is, but we're going to do it with a small array to keep the numbers simple. And in my first example, I'm just statically dividing up the work into two pieces. So I'm going to take elements 0 through 512 and elements 512 through 1024 and sum them up in separate threads. And the way I've done this is I've written a function to sum up 0 through 512 and a function to sum up 512 through 1024. And each of these functions are going to read from a global array and write to some their partial sums to a global array. And I have my sort of driver function, which presumably we're going to call from main or something like that. That's going to create the two threads, join each of the threads, so wait for them to finish. Note that the threads are going to run immediately when we start creating them. The join doesn't care when the threads actually finish. It just waits for them to have finished, either not waiting at all if they finished already or waiting until that happens. And once they've both finished, then we can read the results values, which we know will have actually been written, and have the correct partial sums. We add them together to get the total sum of the whole array. Some questions about how this code sort of sums up our values array. Okay. So we're going to refine this code because there's some things you might not like about it. So one thing you might not like about it is that these numbers are hard-coded. That seems like the thing we don't want to do in a real program. Another thing you might not like about it is that this seems like duplicating code. We're going to find ways of avoiding that. But for now, this is kind of the simplest way of doing it. So let's think about how this actually runs. So when we're running this, we're going to think of our thread layout. So we're going to have our main thread, you know, where we have like main calls something, that calls something, that eventually calls sumall. There's our assumption. I wasn't explicit about where sumall is called, and it doesn't actually matter, but to keep things simple, we're going to assume it's called for mains indirectly somehow. And we're starting these two new threads, and each of them are going to be allocated their own stack. So that's going to be somewhere in the process's virtual memory. We're going to have the stack for those two threads, which means we're going to have a couple of different stacks in our process's memory, and that's perfectly fine. And each of these two threads are going to have their own program counter, their own register values that are going to be managed by the OS and stored either in the OS's memory, if the threads aren't active on a processor, or on some processor. And their program counters are going to point to different places in the process's code. Their registers, well, they're going to have at least a stack pointer pointing to different stacks. You know, there are two different stacks. Questions about our layout here. Okay, so that's kind of our simple case. So what we didn't like here is that, so what we probably don't like here, you know, where we're going to fix, the biggest thing is that this is a lot of code duplication. Sure, it'd be nice to not do that. And probably the most straightforward thing to do is to say, well, this ignored argument seems like we should try to use that so we can have one function that looks at an argument and does one of these two things. So that's what I'll show kind of next. So here, I'm going to pass the argument, and I'm going to do this ugly trick. So I pthread create only lets you have a function that takes a void star argument and returns a void star. No, you cannot use any other types. That's the type of function pointer pthread create takes. So the way I've decided to deal with that is that a pointer is an integer. So I have decided to take the integer 0 or 1 and convert that to a pointer, and then convert it back from a pointer to an integer. And it is just because pthread create doesn't give me the option of actually passing a normal integer, I can only pass a pointer. So I just shove my integer in a pointer and take it out. So I'm passing the integer 0 or 1 as a pointer. I'm converting it from a pointer back into an integer, and then using that integer to decide what to do. Yes. Question, if I didn't cast it, would it still compile? Possibly. If that happens and you don't get warnings, I suggest changing your compiler options. Yes. Question, is there a specific reason why it has to be a void star? So the pthread create designers chose it to be a void star because that is kind of the most flexible type they can have for a single argument type, right? Because you can take a pointer to anything and put it in a void star. And the way C works, right, we can't convert, you know, I can't convert an, you know, int foo int, you know, I can't get a pointer, I can't convert that to a, I can't do function pointer of declared like this equals foo, where the f pointer here, this is that, that's how you declare a pointer to a function that takes a void star argument and returns a void star. Yes, the syntax is horrible. I know some of you have seen this in CS01, some of you have not. And we're not gonna have you write function pointer code generally, but that's how the function has to be, that's how pthread has to be declared. So it has to choose some type to point to the function pointer. So they chose void star because it's the most flexible, but that means, yeah, it's what we're stuck with. Now, probably you can get away with, you know, so this doesn't work. Probably you could like convert, do a cast and make it work, but that is not guaranteed to be portable. In particular, right, the when pthread create calls our function, it's using whatever the calling convention says is the way to pass pointers. On x86, if we're comparing pointers and integers, no problem, right? They're passed the same way. But there's some other platforms where that might not be the case. And because of that, like, you really should just only pass pointers through and convert explicitly. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, you look like you have a question. What a question, what would I use to cast to a void star?
Like, is this like the only way to do it?
Question, is this the only way to do it? So, as we'll see in some future examples, like, I could allocate something and pass a pointer, convert that pointer to a void star and back. Maybe you consider that more proper. And that's going to allow us to, for example, maybe pass the results array and not have it be a global. So that's, I think, typically what ends up happening in a more complex application, is that we'll allocate something, convert that to a void star, convert it back, and that's what void stars are meant for, whereas this kind of isn't what void stars are meant for. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so that's where I'll finish up today, and we'll look through some more refinements on this next time.